Then I will begin the show. Okay, today's lecture is entitled Cognitive Psychology and the Subpersonal Justification of Belief. Today's lecture is a bit different from any of the work I presented thus far because it's based on joint work, a work I did with a philosopher at the University of Glasgow named J. Adam Carter, who used to be a postdoc at Edinburgh. I had an appointment there for some time, secondary appointment. And we got to working on this. And he's really an epistemologist. So he specializes in the area of philosophy that focuses on theories of knowledge, what it is to know something, under what conditions humans can know things or not know things. In a way, I guess what I'm trying to do in this lecture is to take my perspective on the levels free architecture, the elimination of the personal level, I've sometimes called it, the flattened architecture, I've sometimes called it, take that perspective and try to bring it to bear on a problem that's been of interest to philosophers for many, many centuries, and show that cognitive science can maybe help to solve or at least shed light on a philosophical issue that maybe many philosophers thought the sciences wouldn't be able to help us with. I'll say a bit more about that as we go along. And as far as the joint work goes, I'm gonna focus on my side of the work here on the bearing of cognitive science on the problem, whereas Adam focuses more on the problem itself, the epistemological problem. So what is that problem? What is the problem that I want to address with cognitive science? Let's begin with some very general comments on truth and knowledge. The goal of intellectual life, particularly in the academic world, is to pursue truth and to attain knowledge. These are two ways of talking, they're very common, but is there a difference between these two goals, between finding truth and attaining knowledge? They often seem to be treated interchangeably when people talk in grand terms about academia or about an intellectual life. In ancient Greece, Plato expressed the view through the mouth of Socrates, his teacher, that knowledge is more valuable than mere true belief. In other words, justified true belief is more valuable than mere true belief. This wording is very important because justified true belief is often used as a formula for knowledge, as an equivalent way of describing knowledge. So the big difference between knowledge, pursuing knowledge and pursuing truth is justification. That's the difference between mere true belief, just having the truth, or having knowledge, which is justified true belief. It's all about the justification. Now, more controversially, and I'll add this just to acknowledge a big strand in the literature. More controversially, the claim is that knowledge has more final, ultimate, or intrinsic value, just good for its own sake, not merely as an additional, as an instrument, for it's valued as a means to an end. So yeah, the claim is that knowledge has more of this ultimate value, not merely additional instrumental value as a means to an end than mere true belief. I will sometimes be talking about instrumental value. I won't make a big deal about this distinction. And this is partly because I think we are doing two things when we bring the sciences into philosophy. When we bring cognitive science into philosophy, one of the things we're doing is trying to solve the philosophical problem, show what the answer is to the philosophical problem. But in other cases, we're doing something I referred to the other day in a previous lecture as the psychology of philosophy. We are trying to explain why philosophers have intuitions that they have or reactions that they have, and even if those reactions or those intuitions might be incorrect. So, maybe if we explain why justified true belief is more useful than merely having the truth, we will also be able to see why someone would have thought otherwise. We'll be able to, in a way, deflate that intuition about intrinsic, ultimate, or final value. This is a fine point. It won't play an important role in what follows. So as I said, justification is the difference. We pursue truth, but not truth by accident or by lottery. It should be based on evidence, well-supported and justified. That's what marks the difference between merely possessing the truth on the one hand and acquiring knowledge on the other. Consider a metaphor. A parable, it might be. A story about another situation that we're going to end up comparing to knowledge. Consider two delicious cups of coffee, one produced by a machine that reliably produces delicious cups of coffee, the other produced by a machine that only occasionally produces a delicious cup of coffee, and which on this occasion has done so. So the two cups of coffee are in this case indistinguishable. One was produced by a reliable coffee maker, produces delicious cups of coffee day in, day out, and the other was kind of a lucky outcome, a wonderful cup of coffee produced by a machine that usually produces kind of mediocre or not so great cups of coffee. This example is due, I believe, originally to Linda Zagzebski. Jonathan Quandig has a similar example involving chocolate. And what's common to these kinds of cases, again, is that two different processes, one reliable, one generally unreliable, end up producing the same thing on a single occasion. And it really is the same thing. There's no difference in taste between the two cups of coffee. There's no reason to prefer one over the other. The reliability of the process, the way one arrived at the cups of coffee, doesn't add any value to the first cup of coffee over and above what the second cup has. This leads us to the swamping problem, as it's called in epistemology. This is the problem of saying why you might think one of the cups of coffee is better than the other, has more value than the other, even though they otherwise seem to be just the same. As in the case of coffee, well, put it this way, in the case of the coffee, the very just goodness of the gustatory quantity, right, of the coffee itself as a consumable, that goodness is the same in the two cups. And so it seems to overshadow or make irrelevant the contribution of the process that led up to it. If you had to pick one of the two coffee makers to own, you would want to own the reliable coffee maker. Nevertheless, if you have to pick between these two cups of coffee that have been made on this particular occasion, they're indistinguishable, they're equally good, doesn't matter. To preferring one doesn't seem to matter. So the value of the goodness of the liquid seems to override the value of the process. And that's the swamping problem, now transferred to the case of knowledge. The value of truth seems to swamp or overwhelm or eclipse or wash out, or as I said a moment ago, make irrelevant the value of justification. Once you've got the truth, it doesn't seem to matter how you got there. As in the case of the cup of coffee, having a justified true belief seems no more valuable than having a true belief. The value resides in the truth, not in its being justified. Now, one might be skeptical about the appropriateness of the comparison, belief formation and justification to making a cup of coffee. From a naturalistic perspective, though, if we are to understand the difference between justified true belief and merely true belief, the most promising place to look is at the process that led to the adoption of the belief. That is a very common place for scientifically minded epistemologists to look. We ask whether the belief was arrived at by wishful thinking or a lucky guess on one hand, or whether it was the result of careful deliberation, say, or visual inspection. And this leads to a widely held view, I think originally due to Alvin Goldman, called process reliabilism. On this view, a belief is justified if and only if it was produced by a process that tends to produce true beliefs. Sometimes people simply say more true beliefs than not. But the general idea is that it has a tendency to produce true beliefs, even if sometimes it fails. Visual perception reliably produces true beliefs, one might think. So any belief produced by visual perception is justified regardless of whether it's true. And if one has a true belief produced by standard visual processing, then one has knowledge, because now one has a justified true belief. So much of the rest of the lecture will be an attempt to kind of make sense of process reliabilism in light of this swamping problem. I try to make the history of belief formation and the maintenance of the belief understood as a subpersonal phenomenon, to try to make to find a source of value there, to find a source of value beyond the truth of the belief. We kind of locate something good that's happening, something worthwhile about the belief that gives it some extra value over and above just its truth. And we will be looking at subpersonal processes. Process reliabilism doesn't necessarily tell us to focus on subpersonal processes, but it encourages a scientific picture of the world. And when we pursue the science, cognitive science seems to deliver a lot of work on subpersonal processes, as that distinction is commonly made. So one possible way to solve the swamping problem is to focus on the subpersonal processes at work. Do the subpersonal processes of belief formation or belief maintenance create justification-related value beyond just the value of having the truth? Regardless of whether the personal level exists or whether personal level states are the only things that have epistemic value, certain forms of subpersonal level processing provide the grounds for or source of the value in question. Now, as those of you who attended the first lecture know, I oppose this idea of a personal level. I think modeling in cognitive science and across the sciences appeals to items from different domains and different levels and what are thought of as different levels. And maybe this is a reason to stop talking about levels entirely in any of the sciences, cognitive science or otherwise. But I'm not too invested in this idea that we're going to talk about these processes as subpersonal, but that's what they would normally be called, the processes I'm gonna focus on throughout the rest of the lecture. But swamping is normally thought of as a personal problem, personal level problem. As it's normally presented, the swamping problem involves belief, a component of the folk psychological framework. And in discussions of the problem, one frequently sees references to credit, responsibility, and achievement. Now, I want to acknowledge that one of the possibilities of the flattened view that I accept is that belief will be eliminated. I think sometimes belief begins to look like some of the other kinds I've spoken skeptically about, concepts or memory, that there really isn't a single phenomenon, belief. There are lots of representational structures that play different kinds of roles, but there isn't a kind of thing that shows up in cognitive scientific modeling that corresponds to our pre-scientific concept of belief or pre-scientific description of belief. So I'm not even sure this talk about belief is appropriate, but I don't want to press that very hard. Beliefs might show up in our cognitive scientific models, our best models, but they would be down there amongst with the subpersonal ones. Nevertheless, I want to acknowledge that most epistemologists, when they talk about this problem, they're thinking about it as a personal level problem. More generally, Western epistemology has focused on personal level phenomena, the justificatory role of the conscious appreciation of content or the conscious acceptance of an inference, for example. What I'm doing is a significant departure. In lecture one, as I noted already, I argued for the rejection of the personal subpersonal distinction. In the lectures that followed, I've pursued a vision of mental content, cognitive architecture, cognitive systems that dovetails with this flattened or levels eliminating approach. This has been a major theme running through the lectures. Today's lecture continues in the same vein, although in this case, I allow myself to speak of the personal level because this is done freely in Western epistemology, because this is how the swamping problem is normally put. But the arguments presented here can be reconstructed within a cognitive architecture flattened from above. Anytime you think, hey, there's a higher level and there's a lower level, and I want to say something interesting about the lower level and its contribution, you can always rephrase that. Say, hey, all these things are on the same level, but I'm going to focus on sort of one corner of that level. One level of the house can have many rooms on it, and you can go to one of the rooms of the house and focus on that one and clean that one or organize that one without looking at the others. So even if I'm right and there is no personal level, there's still an important question here about which parts of the cognitive scientific model are playing which role, or where, if value is being added during the formation of beliefs or belief-like states, where that value is coming from over and above its truth, if it is a true belief. So a simple way to proceed then for present purposes is to assume that talk of the personal level is nothing more than talk about conscious states, even if they don't appear at a different level from the level of subconscious cognitive processing. In which case the arguments to follow can be recast in those terms, just in terms of conscious versus subconscious processes. All right, so what is the subpersonal strategy for solving the swamping problem? Typically, subpersonal processing is more complex than personal level processing. In the case of linguistic uptake, one hears the incoming sentence and then has a belief that inherits its meaning. You hear your friend say, "I ate a hamburger for dinner last night," and then you immediately believe that your friend ate a hamburger for dinner last night. But the subpersonal process of taking in your friend's spoken words and processing them and then forming a belief is, from the subpersonal perspective, incredibly complex. It involves detection of various acoustical properties in the input, a segmenting of words, association of words with maybe syntactic structure, with the activation of other representations that we might think of as the meaning throughout the brain. So it's a very complex process. And then you have to store that memory. It's not simply a fleeting experience. You remember that your friend ate a hamburger, and that is part of forming the belief. So that process is quite complex. The conscious process is much simpler, though. As I said, it's just a matter of having this meaningful sound pop into your head when your friend opens his mouth, and then having a belief afterwards that you can access consciously and report on. But perhaps we can better understand the value of the justificatory processes if we examine some of this additional subpersonal structure. Now, it really is additional structure. There is a kind of mismatch in the structure and processing profiles at the personal and subpersonal levels. So the idea is not to examine the precise physical basis of a personal level state, say a single justified true belief, to see whether we can find some source of value in that physical basis that isn't apparent at the personal level. If you are a naturalist, you will believe that psychological phenomena are grounded, say, in the brain or the body, or perhaps even the other physical environment, but they are grounded physically. Ultimately, any thought you have, any conscious experience you have, is it takes a physical form. It is implemented at the physical level. And sometimes the reaction I get when I talk about this kind of material is the following. People will say, yes, but of course there's a subpersonal basis. And of course, that could be interesting, but that's just the basis of the beliefs themselves, or the basis of the inference process at the conscious level. part of what I am emphasizing, and Adam and I are emphasizing, is that this subpersonal structure is, it's not merely the correlating process, the pieces that that realize, the word sometimes used in philosophy. It's not just the physical form of the belief itself. It's a bunch of extra stuff that's happening at the subpersonal level that has no image or no corresponding structure at the personal level. It's subpersonal level structure that doesn't march in lockstep with anything at the personal level. It's just additional. So that makes the inquiry, that makes our investigation particularly subpersonal level. It's distinctively about these other processes, not merely just the physical shape that the personal level processes take. So rather the physical basis of the personal level state participates in complex processing that has no image or matching structure at the personal level. It doesn't appear there at all. Perhaps all of this subpersonal level structure and processing provides a source of value in cases in which the subpersonal processing itself has justification-related properties. I will talk about justification-related properties because sometimes philosophers are very wedded to the idea that justification appears only at the personal level, that it doesn't make any sense to talk about justification at the subpersonal level. I don't find that sort of resistance compelling. It is tied to the strong desire on the part of some philosophers to keep the personal level separate from science. But the point is, I can use this more careful language, say, hey, some of the things that happen at the subpersonal level are justification related. Clearly, they relate to properties that we normally would identify as providing justification. And so that's good enough. That's good enough to add epistemic value to the states. So I'm going to argue. All right, so let's look at some of the details. Encoding is an important part of the operation. When I gave my example earlier, my friend saying, I ate a hamburger for dinner last night. One of the things that has to happen is that there has to be an initial encoding of that speech stream. And if it's something I'm going to remember, there has to be a long-term encoding. So the episode might start out, as the story goes these days, it starts out and then hippocampus is where the episodic memory is initially encoded. And then through the course of memory consolidation, it will be transferred. The encoding will be transferred to frontal cortex, and perhaps maintaining some vestige of it in hippocampus. That's a running debate at this point, whether there is a trace left behind in hippocampus even after the transfer to frontal cortex. For a subject to acquire a belief and continue to possess it, it must be encoded and maintained in a form that makes it accessible and allows it to function as a belief within the cognitive system. The subpersonal processes that effect such encoding and maintenance often, at the same time, create or reinforce justification-relevant relations, for example, by situating the belief in an inferential network. One way in which this happens is through a kind of replaying of experiences. And it can happen whether one is awake or asleep, but much of the focus on this kind of replaying, reactivation theory has been in sleep. So consider the role of sleep in learning and memory fixation. During slow wave sleep, representations of facts, propositions, sometimes called declarative memories, are reactivated and strengthened. Much of this is a systems level process, not simply a matter of local synaptic changes that render the encoding resistant to interference. It's a matter of fitting in the new memory with all of the other things encoded in the brain. And so properties of the entire neural network are important, not just kind of finding some neurons to encode the new belief or memory in. And here I'll include a quote from Duday, Carney, and Born, The Consolidation and Transformation of Memory from Neuron a few years back. Consolidation is a dynamic, generative, transformative, and lingering process that is posited to balance maintenance of useful experience-dependent internal representations of the world with the need to adapt these representations to the changing world. Now, I think it's more common for people to have heard about the role of sleep in reinforcing skill learning. So that is one thing that happens, is if you've practiced a skill, then as you rest afterwards, particularly when you're asleep, but not necessarily only when you're asleep, the skill will be reinforced by internal processing. If you're deprived of that sleep, then your this skill improvement will not appear to such an extent. But the question is whether this applies to belief formation as well. That's an important question in this context. Excuse me. But going on from the same article, Duday, Carney, and Born, they say there is also growing evidence that this sleep-associated redistribution of information is accompanied with an increased semanticization of memories and the abstraction of just information from episodic representations. Well, this extracting of just information and the storing of it would be to acquire a belief. And they say, a few pages later, the hypothetical process of systems consolidation is most commonly discussed within the context of declarative memory. Same section. Hence, one may hypothesize that instead of external cues, reactivated pre-existing schemas in neocortical sites direct sleep-dependent consolidation. For example, by favoring the hippocampal reactivation of that memory information that fits the pre-existing schema. All right, so this sounds a little obscure, but the idea is that there are already in the cognitive system representational structures. Some of them involve expectations about the way the world is. You might think models of the world or theories of the world or pieces of general information, clusters of pieces of information about the world. And the reactivation of recent experiences, as they've been encoded at least temporarily in hippocampus, the reactivation and then replaying of those is determined partly by the way that recent experience fits with the rest of the information. There's a kind of selectivity there, but it's not merely a matter of the existing information looking for something that fits it perfectly. There's some accommodation of the existing structure to a new memory as well. But it may, the accommodation process may change that memory as it's being re-encoded, change it from its original content to some extent. Prior knowledge schemata shape the engagement of the hippocampus in declarative consolidation. It's just another statement of the process I was just describing. The encoding and stabilization process brings memory-based content into a stable relation with other elements in the knowledge store, your memory, your commitments, your beliefs. It situates the memory in a network of representational structures, which facilitates association and inference, effective processing. When the gist of a memory is extracted and encoded in this way, a semantic memory, it constitutes a belief. There's some element of justification here as well, insofar as this process puts the cemented structure, the memory belief, into reliable inferential relations. That is part of the way we think of justification is in terms of what inferences can lead to it. if you arrive at a true belief by a lucky guess or by wishful thinking, that is part of what we criticize in that case. What's missing is justification. And in particular, what we would have liked to see is we'd like to see you arrive at true belief by a thought process that, say, reasons through steps, rather than just guessing and happening to get it right. Consistency is also important in your overall set of beliefs. It's the kind of justification-related property that's important. A belief being consistent with one's other beliefs provides a form of justification. I say this about beliefs, but this may be true of representational structures more broadly. But one can't check for such consistency explicitly at the personal level. The computational and attentional demands are too great. So Christopher Cherniak in the 1980s published a book called Minimal Rationality, in which he went through some of this formally, said, look, if you, let's say you believe 100 different things, you know, 100 different personal level beliefs, which is a tiny fraction, I think, of what most of us would say we believe. I believe thousands and thousands of things. But even if you just had 100, the idea of going through and checking amongst all those 100 beliefs to make sure none of them contradict each other is incredibly computationally demanding. It's somewhere around 100, I think, where Cherniak shows that it would take more time than there is in the history of the universe to check all those beliefs. So it's really the combinatorial problem here is outrageously daunting. So the idea that I could sit down and run through all my beliefs and check to make sure that they're consistent with each other is seems to be off the table. So where does consistency come from then, if it's not a personal level process or something that simply mirrors a personal level process? Well, a recently formed belief life structure will repeatedly be checked for consistency at the subpersonal level as part of the process of cementing and maintaining it, which automatically confers some justification on it. Now, the subpersonal level process cannot go like the personal level one because the computational demands would be too great. But there are tools, most of them developed by computer scientists. The possible tools for maintaining consistency are many and varied. The candidates typically involve sophisticated sampling algorithms. So the idea is that maybe you have thousands of beliefs, but if you have a way of sampling selections of them and just sort of testing samples, you're likely to maintain consistency even if you don't, even if you haven't thoroughly searched them all. This kind of process is not experienced at the conscious level. It's not really clear how to go about doing this. The sampling algorithms need to be implemented in a kind of computing machinery, so to speak, and our conscious experience doesn't really have the structure of computing machinery. So it looks like this will be at the subpersonal level, if it's anywhere. We're not consciously aware of such processing, nor is there any other reason to attribute the application of these algorithms to the personal level. Thus, the processes that maintain consistency as best the human organism can by the use of some kind of heuristic are most likely subpersonal. The beliefs are justified, they get additional justification because the subpersonal processes don't just deliver us the beliefs, they increase justificatory status by enhancing consistency. And also by enhancing consistency, they make such beliefs more valuable. They make the beliefs more valuable if for no other reason than that this process of checking for consistency and maintaining them cements them and gives them the causal profile to play a role in the cognitive system. And this leads to what I'm going to call a degenerate result. There's nothing particularly bad about it. I mean it in the sense of a kind of mathematical proof. The degenerate result is a degenerate case is one in which your hypothesis holds for some very simple reason, like a precondition hasn't been met for the hypothesis to be wrong. I'll try to be clear about what I have here. So assume that true beliefs have some positive degree of non-instrumental value. Just truth is good in and of itself. And that a non-existent belief has zero such value. I mean, it doesn't exist. There's an absence of value that would be there if true belief had existed. So you have a true belief, it's got some value. A non-existent belief has less because it's zero. The comparison between having a merely true belief and having a justified true belief is often like this. It's a matter of comparing the value of no belief at all to the value of a justified true belief, because merely true beliefs quickly disappear. That's the key idea. So if truth is valuable at all, a justified true belief is the clear winner. It has more value. It has more value because it has non-zero value. It has a positive value. And the merely true belief is almost certain to go out of existence or never get cemented. This is the correspondence, the convergence that I especially want to emphasize. It's kind of at the root of, or it's one of the root ideas of today's lecture, is that we tend to think of personal level belief acquisition as somehow kind of automatic, or it almost seems like magic, you know, hearing your friend say, I ate a hamburger for dinner last night, and then just having that thought and then being able to remember it tomorrow. If you see your friend say, "Hey, did you have a hamburger again?" You know? We take these things for granted without really any knowledge of how they happen. The belief just seems to be something we get. We don't know how it contrasts with all of the other things we heard people say on the same day that have gone out of our minds. You know, we forget all kinds of things that happen to us throughout the day. We're not really in a position at the personal level to compare the process that produced the true belief that stayed, right? My memory of my friend having said he ate a hamburger for dinner. We're not in a position to compare that process to the process that was operative in so many other cases where other people said things to me throughout the day that just went in one ear and out the other, as a common phrase has it, that they did not stick. They did not get recorded and replayed and cemented. So the subpersonal processing that turns transforms a proto-belief or incipient belief, initial representation, into a full-fledged belief automatically confers justification on that belief by setting it within a reliable inferential network that was the accommodation within knowledge schemas, and by establishing its consistency with one's other beliefs. One way to think about this is by temporal aggregation of value, because you might think that beliefs, even the ones that don't really get very well justified, they could stick around for a little while before they are weeded out. They may take a while to replay an experience, an episodic memory, and extract the gist from it and cement it. And if that doesn't happen, maybe the trace is still there with the potential to be encoded, even if it is not encoded, and if it sort of falls out of the system or falls by the wayside. One way to acknowledge that temporary existence of the belief is to think in terms of a temporal aggregation of value, over time. Assume that true beliefs have some positive degree of non-instrumental value, then the longer one has a true belief, the more value accrues. It's better to have that true belief for a week than it is to have it for 5 minutes. When a subject acquires a merely true belief, one that does not get justified, it typically will not persist as long as a justified version of the same true belief. Again, because the very process of encoding, integrating, that process that increases the probability that the belief will persist is also a justificatory process. It situates the belief in an inferential network and checks it for consistency. So if it's merely a true belief that's not being justified in any way, then it will be either disappearing or then later it will become justified. So more value accrues to the justified version of it because that process will take longer. You know, it's the comparison here. The comparison in the previous slide was zero to some positive value. And now I'm making a slightly more, this is not the degenerate case. This is a slightly more maybe interesting comparison is to say, okay, you can have a true belief for some short period of time. But as it continues to persist, it will become justified. So once it is justified, it will automatically then have been around for longer and therefore will have more value than the belief that was around for a shorter amount of time prior to when justification started to accrue. Of course, the justified belief, the merely true belief might never become justified and just disappear. And so maybe there was some value to that for a short time. We don't want to say that merely true beliefs never occur at all in any form on that they never have any value. The idea is simply to try to show that in lots of cases, in realistic human cases, justification makes a difference. It makes the belief more valuable. Either because it's the difference between life and death for the belief, whether it exists or not, or it's what keeps the belief in existence. And therefore gives it more value by the aggregation of truth-based value over time. So let's be a little bit more formal about some of this. I'll give you the argument for encoding in a way that presents it in a package. Premise one, in order that an initially formed belief-like state becomes a full-fledged belief, its subpersonal realizer must be integrated into the cognitive system. So a realizer is, in the language of philosophy of mind, is a realizer is the physical implementation of a given state, the physical form it takes on a given occasion. That physical form, say in the brain, has to be integrated into the cognitive system. In order for the belief to continue to be maintained, that is for its realizing subpersonal states not to be eliminated, its subpersonal realizer must continue to survive integration-related subpersonal routines, such as consistency checks. These kinds of integration referred to in the two preceding premises contribute to the belief's justification, again, because they involve inference, or at least inference-like relations, and they involve consistency. In contrast, a belief-like state that is merely true is not typically integrated into the cognitive system or is not maintained after formation, and thus is likely to be eliminated either immediately or before long. Premise five, on the assumption that being true provides some non-instrumental value, a justified true belief has more of it than a non-existent belief, more of it than a belief-like state that is likely to be eliminated after a brief existence. Therefore, in the cases in question, justified true beliefs are more non-instrumentally valuable than the corresponding merely true beliefs. If they are maybe not full-fledged beliefs, they're on their way to becoming beliefs. So I put that in scare quotes. All right, and here's now that that argument's been kind of, I think, explained and summarized, here's a argument that is has a similar inspiration behind it, but a different focus. The focus here will be on content, on what it takes to even have a belief that's an attitude toward a certain proposition or expresses a certain content. According to this argument, various subpersonal processes mediate the initial fixation of the representational content of a mental representation, and also sustain the relationships that keep the representational value fixed. So one way to think of representational content for mental representations, going back to some of last week's lectures, is to think of these on a tracking model. Now, this is a very simple version of some of what I talked about, but it's, I think, a good place to start, is to think about, say, visual tracking. When you watch a bird fly through the sky, you're doing something that feels very natural from the first person standpoint, but it's a sophisticated skill. It's quite an achievement for any animals to be able to visually track an object, maybe their prey in some cases that they're going to, you know, attack and eat. So visual tracking is a process by which the subject, you know, you, the individual or the animal, maintains contact with the object of their thought, the thing that they see or are thinking about. Now, in that case, the individual is immediately entrained by this object in the environment. You're kind of in, it feels like immediate contact with it as you watch it move through the sky, if it's a bird, say. But I think some people want to generalize this idea when they talk about representational content. The idea is that for me to represent something is to track it more generally over time. In the example I gave in one of last week's lectures, I talked about meeting someone. I met a new person named John, who was introduced to. And then I saw John a week later at the shopping mall and said hi to him, waved and said hello. And that's a kind of tracking. That's kind of keeping tabs on something over time, being able to recognize it, to recognize it, to re-identify it. And those kinds of actions, that kind of tracking, is mediated by many subpersonal processes. Some of those subpersonal processes will be representational themselves. Now, that doesn't mean the other subpersonal processes define the content of the representation in question. Maybe ultimately, the only way to characterize the content or representational value of my representation of John is just that it's a representation of John. It's related to him in a certain way. It was he who caused the initial formation of it, or repeatedly caused its activation and its early formation, things like that. So ultimately, representational content may be pointed at the world, just pointed at its object, its external object, in the classic case. Nevertheless, other representational vehicles, other mental representations may contribute to the exercise of the skill of being able to recognize John throughout different environments and across different contexts. So they will sustain the relations that keep representational value fixed. These are sometimes talked about as sustaining mechanisms. Eric Margolis has called them that, and Fiona Coey, I'm not sure who, it was about the same time in the 90s, people started talking that way. So this leads to a kind of intermediate conclusion. Subpersonal processes partly determine the identity of a proposition believed. So if I believe that my friend ate a hamburger, that belief is partly made up of a representation of my friend and hamburgers, and also the action of eating. These relations, the relations that are involved in subpersonal processing are inferential, broadly speaking, at least in most cases. I'm not making a conscious inference when I see John across the mall and recognize, and I just immediately say, hey, there's the guy I met last week. Hey, that's the guy John that I was introduced to. There may be no conscious appreciation of an inference, but it might be that my visual system and other parts of my cognitive system are picking up on various cues, subconscious cues of John's presence. It may be that his nose has a very kind of unique or distinctive shape. something about his profile is you know different from other people. Those might be features that we don't even have words for in natural language. We might have to use a mathematical formalism to characterize the property of the nose line that is being used by the subconscious or subpersonal processing system to recognize John. But it's a kind of inference. It goes from a representation of a particular profile of a nose to the activation of a representation of John. And it may not be the kind of process that many people have in mind when they talk about inference, where someone has an explicit rule, on Wednesday I had modus ponens and modus tollens as rules of reasoning up on a slide, right? So many people who like logical formalism will think, yes, modus ponens, if P then Q, P, therefore Q. And that may be a paradigm of inference, but it seems to me that this is inference as well. Tracking features of an item so as to recognize the item is a kind of, it's a kind of inference. It's diagnosis, it's a diagnostic process. So we have this second intermediate conclusion. The subpersonal processes in question have justificatory force. If a process establishes a relationship or exploits a relationship that's a reliable inference, then you've got a justification-related process going on. All right, premise three. For a belief to remain in existence, its components must continue to refer to the individuals, properties, et cetera, that constitute the proposition believed. So my friend told me he ate a hamburger last night. If for some reason I have lost the ability to think about my friend, I can no longer track that friend, then I can't have the same belief. I can't continue to believe that that person ate a hamburger because I can't even think about that person anymore. So intermediate conclusion number two, a belief that does not continue to stand in content fixing and maintaining relations goes out of existence. I should say a belief, the parts of which do not continue to stand in content fixing and maintaining relations goes out of existence and thus has less value than one that remains in existence, which will in contrast be justified to some extent. The recognitional acts of John are justified by its relation to the diagnosing factors, say the shape of his nose. Therefore, a justified true belief is more non-instrumentally valuable than a merely true belief. And this value is determined subpersonally. And it's, again, it's a matter of persistence. If a belief stays in existence, it does so partly by continuing to enter into justificatory relations, true belief included, right? If it's going to stick around, it's entering into justificatory relations. When it stops entering into justificatory relations, it disappears. So a merely true belief is short-lived, whereas a justified true belief can stick around. And the sticking around is itself deeply tied to the justification. So this is, I was going to run through an example. It's a lot like the example of recognizing John at the mall, but I'll go through this one as well. So imagine that when one arrives home, one recognizes that one's dog is in the house via a subpersonal olfactory process, recognizing the distinctive dog smell. Maybe the dog has been outside in the rain, for instance. That can be a very distinctive smell. This is justification and content related because it helps one continue to track dogs successfully, to sort of keep in touch with them in the world, which on many naturalistic theories of content determines content. And it does so by a relationship that is at least loosely inferential and thus justification related. Thus, it's possible that in some such cases, if the subpersonal inferential relations decay or change, the related belief goes out of existence. Now, it may take a fair amount of loss or decay, something of inferential relations to really lose touch with the objects in the world, but it can happen over time. People's recognitional capacities change, inferential relations change, and if you're thinking about a sort of merely true belief as the alternative, it seems like that's at least a possibility to lose so many of the inferential relations, the ones that help you to recognize the objects in question. You could lose so many of those that the belief itself disappears, or is unlikely to last for long, because you won't be able to track the objects anymore. All right. Thus, in many cases, the contribution of the subject's subpersonal cognitive system keeps a belief or belief-like state in existence by maintaining the tracking capacities that determine the semantic content of components of the proposition that belief is an attitude toward. If the networks that establish and maintain content change, the content changes, and thus the belief disappears. So long as those networks are also conferring justification, you now have a tie between the continued existence of a belief and justification. Justification goes along with continued existence. So if it's a true belief, you've got value accruing to that from the truth. The merely true belief goes out of existence because its content changes. Here's one other approach, a kind of similar idea, is that one way in which our beliefs are maintained is by kind of interacting with the world and having our expectations confirmed or reinforced. So I put this briefly as an action-based, an argument from action-based maintenance. Beliefs give rise to sensory and motor expectations. The mere act of using a belief justifies it to the extent that the sensory and motor expectations are met. And if they aren't met, the belief is likely to be abandoned or revised. Now, much of this happens subconsciously, very quickly. Many models of motor control involve, I think I talked about these in lecture 5, forward models, the sending of efferent copy to a different part of the brain that calculates where motor activity is likely to wind up. So as I begin reaching for my cup of coffee, a motor command is sent to control my arm, but a copy of that is sent to a different part of the brain, and cerebellum, I believe. And a quick simulation, very quick simulation is run, and it predicts where my hand is going to land. And so quickly that if my hand isn't heading for quite the right place, if it's not heading for my cup of coffee, an adjustment can be made in real time to kind of change the trajectory of my arm and get it to land where it's supposed to at my cup of coffee. Now, this is a very specific kind of model, forward models of motor control, but there is a whole host of work in this vein being done in the predictive processing framework, predictive coding, prediction error minimization. Maybe you've heard some of these terms. Andy Clark nowadays is quite enthusiastic about these models. And they all follow, or they have a certain basic dynamic, is that fast subconscious predictions are made about the input that you will receive when you act in a certain way. And so if that input does not match what is expected, then there's kind of a kind of disconfirmation, at least there's a prediction error that needs to be dealt with. And that may be dealt with by abandoning a belief. So as soon as one begins exercising a belief, as soon as one begins acting on a belief, it seems to become justified or else it's abandoned, right? Because confirming the expectations about what your input will be when you act on that belief is itself a kind of justificatory a result, right? Because confirmation is a kind of justification. Thus, a merely true belief hasn't been good for anything. If you've got a merely true belief, it must be a belief that hasn't been good for anything. Otherwise, it would have become justified. Expectations on the basis of it would have been confirmed, or else it would have been eliminated. It would no longer be a merely true belief. It would now be a justified true belief. So you can't do much with a merely true belief, because once you start doing anything with it, it becomes justified, because it either becomes justified or it gets thrown out. So it doesn't last very long as a merely true belief. So we're back to sort of that theme of merely true beliefs having maybe some small amount of value for the due to the truth for the period they're in existence, but for them to persist, guiding action or fixing content or whatnot, justification will sort of be automatically accruing to them, because the processes that keep them in existence are themselves justification related, like confirming the expectations of behavior based on a belief. That's justificatory. All right, so here's an objection. This is all merely implementation. The subpersonal processes in question are a matter of mere implementation, and thus a source of value in only a very weak sense. They just kind of tell us how the value-creating personal level processes appear in a physical world, at the physical level. After all, any personal level state with value must have that value determined in some way by realizing subpersonal states, by the actual physical states that implement them. At least that's what you're going to think if you think the universe is ultimately a physical system. It's not helpful, the objector says, to be told that subpersonal level states realize in some way or other the justification relations that hold between personal level states. But here's the response, the rejoinder. Notice the structural mismatch. Many of the relevant subpersonal processes have no image at the personal level. There's no matching process at the personal level that the subpersonal ones are merely an implementation of. These subpersonal processes involve states and processes that don't correspond to any structure at the personal level that the subpersonal processes might march in lockstep with and be mere implementations of. Neither conscious experience nor the way we might describe human thought using the terms from everyday psychology, like belief and desire and hope and fear, delivers the relevant structure. The subpersonal processes in question determine the justification relevant properties. What inferences the personal level state can serve as premises in, for example, without any correlated personal level processes. Individuals are not aware of the communication between hippocampus and frontal cortex when memories are being reactivated at a very low level to consolidate them in frontal cortex. We have no evidence that this is a personal, from the personal level, nothing's happening at all. There's no structure at all. Is there an effective surrejoinder from the critic, a response to my response to the critic's criticism? Well, the critic might say, but there does seem to be a personal level explanation. If we look at it coarsely enough, like if we pull out far enough and just look at very big categories, right, we might say justification creates stability and stability is valuable. Why bother with any further subpersonal story? Hasn't this answered the swamping problem? Just say that justification creates stability and stability is valuable. But response, it's not a conceptual or necessary truth that justification creates stability. It need not. For humans, it depends on truths about the way our cognitive systems work subpersonally. Understanding those processes yield some surprising facts about the problem itself that one would not have uncovered from the personal level perspective alone. In particular, that, roughly speaking, unjustified beliefs are a tenuous category. Like one of the things that has run through these various arguments I've been giving for the last hour or so is that when you've got a merely true belief, which means a true belief that's not justified, you've got a fleeting belief. You've got something that is unlikely to be maintained, unlikely to be consolidated, unlikely to be cemented, unlikely to continue to control behavior, it so many of the properties required for a belief to continue in its existence. So many things are required, and these things, it turns out, have justificatory dimensions to them, which the personal level doesn't really tell us. You know, at the personal level, we just seem to, you know, we have this idea that, oh, some beliefs are better based than others. They have a firmer basis than others in justification. But it seems like from the personal level standpoint, like, why couldn't I have unjustified beliefs? Maybe I have all kinds of unjustified beliefs. But this is, it turns out, not necessarily true. Now, the notion of justification we're working with here is inference, reliable inference, consistency. People do use these tools to arrive at many false beliefs. So some of what we're calling justified beliefs will be false, but that's not really what the issue is. We acknowledge that there can be lots of false beliefs. The question is that when you do get true beliefs, is it better to have true ones that are justified or true ones that aren't justified? And the theme throughout has been that it's better to have true ones that are justified because for reasons to do with subpersonal processing, if you have a true one that's not justified, it's bound to disappear or never really take shape fully in the first place. All right, well, let's look at one. To finish off the lecture, I want to look at one specific proposal of philosopher Erik Olsen, who has tried to make this personal level story about stability work out. So Erik J. Olsen has argued that a belief's stability and the value that attends stability is achieved by personal level processing. He claims that reliabilist knowledge promotes successful action over time because reliabilist knowledge promotes stability, and stability is conducive to successful action over time. This is last part of that's a direct quote from his paper, Reliabilism, Stability, and the Value of Knowledge from 2007. According to Olsen, when an unreliable process produces a mere true belief, merely true because it's produced by an unreliable process. When an unreliable process produces a mere true belief that P, the very unreliability of that process will likely undercut or neutralize eventually that belief's potential to contribute to successful action. A subject deploys a given mechanism or runs a given process type. I'm treating these as equivalent for present purposes. Repeatedly over the course of her life. Right? So if you're thinking about justification from this naturalistic perspective as a kind of a process the sciences might investigate, it's very common to think about justification in terms of the kind of process that produced a belief. And a belief is justified when and only when that process is reliable. So that's this emphasis on reliability here and the connection between reliability and justification. For Olsen, reliability just is what amounts to justification, the reliability of the kind of process you're applying. Now, in the cases in question, the cases that Olsen is describing, the process type is by hypothesis unreliable because the idea is to consider merely true beliefs. So if you have a true belief, it was produced somehow. But if it's unjustified, the process type that produced it must be unreliable. Otherwise, it would be justified because justification is reliability. Thus, if this process type is unreliable, back to the text, the preponderance of later applications of it, that is, those that occur after the time at which the application of the process led to the fixation of the subject's true belief that P, these will yield false beliefs, which will likely lead to unsuccessful action. So the simple idea here is that, you know, if you have a true belief because of a lucky guess, as you continue to make lucky guesses, you'll get lots of false beliefs. that deploying that process of guessing may get you a true belief once in a while, but the preponderance of cases, in the preponderance of cases, you'll get false beliefs. Now, as Olson sees things, subjects track the sources of their belief, recording which processes produce which beliefs, as well as the rate of past success and failure of various processes to produce beliefs that lead to effective action. So in the example of my lucky guess, you are keeping track of the fact that some of your beliefs were formed by a lucky guess, and you kind of track how successful that method is over time. Thus, a subject who continues to use the process in question, like a lucky guess, will subsequently doubt or reject P, even the true P. Remember, P was our example of a truth arrived at by an unreliable method. So a subject who continues to use the process in question will subsequently doubt or reject P. Given feedback from the world, the subject will detect the falsity of the outputs of the majority of later applications of the process that produced P, which results will call into question P itself, even though P is, in fact, true. That's what we're assuming. Thereby robbing the true belief that P of what would have been its contribution to successful behavior, presumably because the subject abandons or at least takes a highly qualified attitude toward the belief that P and thus does not act on it. So you may have made a lucky guess, gotten it true, gotten the right answer. But once you see that guessing doesn't work for the most part, it leads you to failure in most circumstances, you may withdraw your support even from that lucky guess, the thing that you guessed right. So on Olson's view, this is a way of showing that if a belief is unreliable, it will go out of existence. So there's something, I should not overstate the similarity. If a belief is unreliable, it won't necessarily go out of existence, but it will no longer be trusted or acted on, and that makes it less valuable. So it's only when a belief is produced by a reliable process, which makes it justified, that we will continue to act on it. And that, assuming it's true, it will provide the value of truth to our actions. So there's a certain kind of similarity between Olson's view and our own. But Olson is really focused on the personal level. He requires heavy duty personal level record keeping. In his words, his proposal requires that the agent maintain a mental record, a record in her mind of how beliefs were acquired. Now for philosophers, these are all very personal level terms: agent, mental, mind. Thus, if Olson is correct, we need not consider the sort of subpersonal processes I've been discussing. We can understand the value of justification-related processes by focusing only on the personal level. We can see how stability is brought about at the personal level and how it's connected to justification. We are consciously tracking the justification-related processes, and when we see that a belief has been produced by a reliable process, it takes on the character of a stable belief. So we got now this story about the connection between stability and justification all at the personal level. But here's where things get tricky. Olson's proposal requires that at the personal level, subjects, in fact, track the sources of their belief, which process produced them, in the context of their formation, because that matters with regard to the reliability of a process, which context it's being exercised in. Subjects must do so reasonably accurately. I mean, it's not just that they have a tendency to track sources, they have to be pretty good at it. Subjects must use that information to calculate reasonably accurate track records of their various belief-producing mechanisms. You have to sort of keep track of how successful the different mechanisms are. And subjects must bring the results of those calculations to bear on commitments to past products of their belief-producing mechanisms. for example, to bear on the judgment that a past doxastic output, that means belief, to bring, for example, to bear on the judgment that a past belief of, outputted by a given mechanism is likely to be true and adjust accordingly. Sorry, my attempt to clarify in that sentence made things bogged down a bit. So let's just think about that again. This fourth requirement seems to be that subjects must bring the results of those calculations, keeping track of the success rates of their belief-producing mechanisms in the past. Right? Subjects must bring the results of those calculations to bear on commitments to past products of their belief-producing mechanisms and adjust accordingly. We have to be able to see now that as time has passed, and you have accepted the fact that guessing is generally not very reliable, you have to like go back and apply that retroactively and eliminate any of your existing beliefs that were due to guessing, even the ones that turns out are true. But moreover, given that Olson's account of how justification adds value by creating stability is pitched at the personal level, we should expect subjects to be able to report accurately on the states and processes in question, the ones in connection with A through D. This means we can do experiments and check on this and see whether subjects can really report on these things when they're asked directly about them or probed indirectly. Problem is that personal level just doesn't seem to work this way. The processes that Olson hypothesizes doesn't seem to appear at the subpersonal, at the personal level, possibly not even at the subpersonal level, but that's a bit beside the point right now. There is a wealth of empirical research in cognitive psychology that calls into question all of these required personal level processes, A through D, that I described. Subjects are not particularly good at tracking the sources of their beliefs and differentiating between reliable and unreliable sources. They often can't tell whether if they're exposed to mere information or they're reading some information from an encyclopedia, then when they're tested on those different bits of new information kind of mixed together, they can't reliably differentiate between the sentences that they merely read without any authority behind them or the ones that they were told, you know, they were learning from an encyclopedia from a reliable source. They just don't seem to be tracking the different sources and differentiating between them. Some of this work asks subjects to report on the truth of various statements. Subjects' misreports seem to be driven by mechanisms that they are not sensitive to or are unaware of. For instance, mere exposure to sentences in the past. So in some of these kinds of experiments, subjects will simply read a list of sentences. There's nothing about encyclopedias or authority or reliability or anything. They just say, this is a, you know, reading comprehension exam or a speed of reading test. And the subjects read these sentences and they come back a week later and they're exposed to a new list of sentences, or they're just given a list and asked by the experimenter to indicate which of those sentences are true or false. Now, what you've got on that list are some of the sentences from the initial trial from, you know, a week prior when the subject had come in and performed this supposed reading exam or reading test. Those sentences are on the list, but there are also new sentences, entirely new ones. And, you know, pre-screening is done by independent raters to determine, you know, how likely a subject is to know any of this stuff. So the idea is that all these sentences will be novel. They're unusual sentences. And once you bring the subjects in for the second test and give them a list that mixes together the sentences that they were merely exposed to a week before, along with some new distractor sentences, entirely new ones, subjects don't seem to differentiate. Subjects in a way differentiate between the two cases, but in a very peculiar way, they're more likely to say that the sentences they saw once the week before are true. They seem to have attached truth to sort of mere familiarity So this can happen with fame as well. If you ask subjects to make judgments about how famous people are, photographs that they've been exposed to once before will be are more likely to be categorized as famous than new photographs that are being shoved into the mix. So there's something about just ease of processing is how it's sometimes talked about at the subpersonal level, that we misinterpret and we treat as indication of something positive, whether it's celebrity, fame, or whether it's truth. Moreover, even when subjects are informed of the reliability of different sources, like in my encyclopedia example, their performance improves only marginally when they're sort of explicitly flagged. And one of these experiments, the testimony is coming from a police officer or someone else who's assumed to be in a kind of reliable position of authority in society. Their performance improves only marginally, and even then, only on short timescales, and only when they're given this information in a really explicit way at the right time in the experiment, right? Everything has to be set up very specifically, and it only lasts for a very short time. Whereas Olson's proposal requires long-term tracking of sources and their degree of reliability. You have to, if Olson's right, you have to be sort of tracking over time which beliefs are produced by which source so that you can make a determination about the reliability of the different sources and reject beliefs, even past beliefs that were true. You have to reject these if they end up being produced by a source that's deemed to be unreliable. But the deeming to be unreliable requires keeping track over a period of time, which is very hard to get subjects to do. And even in these cases when their performance is improved with explicit instructions on reliability of sources, it's still not improved very well. They still make lots of mistakes on distractors. So in light of all this, in light of all these personal level failings, the unlikelihood that the personal level kind of story that Olson has told is true, we recommend the subpersonal turn. Absent some other personal level account of the value of stability, that is, of how justification is related to stability, we must turn to the subpersonal. In this lecture, I have done so and have located some potential processes that establish this connection between justification and stability, processes that are invisible from the perspective of the personal level, don't merely implement processes that are present at the personal level. We have found epistemic value in the subpersonal veil, is how Adam and I put it at one point. So, thank you very much.